Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker! Do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together? Is my shit together?
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello and welcome back to Action Jacks. I'm Tom. I'm Ricky on the board. SP Futures. Whack, whack, whack. As they used to say in the trading floor, down 57. NASDAQ Futures down 319. So a continuation of last year's kind of fiasco. So not sure what's causing this, but a big bump down on the Bitcoin stuff. I don't know if that, I don't know enough about it to know if that's part of the problem issue here, but Bitcoin's down to 95,000. From a 126 number a few weeks ago. So, interesting. We have Professor Kevin.
You do? How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing all right. I'm so happy about the future. I'm wearing shades. Well, who's the one who said that?
I've got to get this right, Tom. The future's so bright, I got to wear shades.
Yeah. I mean, it's a...
That's happy. It's not so happy. It's so bright.
Yeah. The, looking at the, First of all, do you ever heard of this lady, Mallory McMorrow, Notre Dame, who's running for Senate in Michigan?
Yeah, you sent something over. She's a pretty standard Democrat, legislator in Michigan.
Evidently, she ripped some guy a new one for accusing her of doing something for supporting sex changes in 8-year-olds or something. She ripped him a new one on the floor. Evidently, it went viral, the Senate floor in Michigan, saying she's not about that at all, and he's an idiot or something. She seems to have some spunk.
Yeah, she's become a very popular guest on MSNBC. They love her, but I think she's running against another legislator who's sort of been one of the Democratic Party regulars. So, I suppose she's got a chance to win the primary for the Senate seat. I don't think she has the party establishment against her, but I do think the party establishment favors the other candidate.
I think they probably do too. My friend Bill Murphy was at one of her, I guess his niece held something for her up in Lake Forest or someplace, and said she's pretty impressive. Of course, a lot of those people are. When you get them in person, I mean, a lot of them are.
It's interesting that her fundraiser is in Lake Forest instead of in Michigan, isn't it?
Well, I mean,
there's a lot of outside money coming into the Michigan race.
I think she said something about...
Because they legitimately could lose the seat to Republicans. So.
I think the number that they were looking at was about 40 mil for the campaign. That's a number.
Yeah.
But actually, the reason why I talked about it is other than her being from Notre Dame and strikingly red-haired Irish girl, which is nice. I'm looking here. I went to Wikipedia, which I know is not your favorite, and they're talking about her political positions. By the way, she refuses to be called a progressive. She thinks she's a pragmatist.
I see.
I like that. So, but it's interesting when they talk about the quiz here on political positions. Nobody mentions stuff like inflation. Nobody mentions. But it is interesting. One of her stuff here is on the Israel-Palestine, because evidently she's married to a Jewish guy, and who's going to a bunch of the AIPAC stuff. I've actually been to a couple of those things. They're pretty interesting. For those that don't know, that's the American-Israeli Political Action Committee. Those are guys that really dig down and get money from people. I mean, it's kind of a scary group. It's a scary group in the sense of how hard they work. It's also
it's very influential too.
But the weird part is if you're a contributor, you're expected and I guess granted with the most I think would think it probably a positive thing, Kevin. I don't know, but let's say you gave them $10,000 or something. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were. It was years ago I went, but if you gave them that kind of dough, you would go to the big convention. I went to the one here in Chicago twice as a guest. But you went to the one in Washington. You are expected to go and see, they'll give you names of like two representatives for 10 grand. If you have 100 grand, you got the names of like two senators. You're supposed to go sit with them. Like make an appointment, or maybe they'll make it for you. And you're supposed to sit down with them and say, these are the points that we're looking for. I mean, it's very legitimate lobbying. And it's funny how you'll hear, you know, uninformed idiots, which I guess we all are at some point in our life, say something, oh man, these people in Congress are there forever. And so the guy at the AIPAC meeting, this is again like 6-7 years ago, he says, nothing could be further from the truth. He goes, the turnover in the House is higher than it's ever been. Now, maybe not the people you see on TV. Because evidently, if you get elected, somewhere along the line in your first 2 or 4 years, they will take you to Israel. I mean, I don't know if they're doing it now with the war, with all the stuff that's happening, but and actually show you, you'd go to the Golan Heights and you'd say, you know, this is why we need cash and we need an army, because right over there, those are like the bad guys. So it's not like in Chicago where you go, yeah, we don't like these Chinese, but by the way, they're, you know, 10,000 miles away sort of thing. So everybody who comes back seems to have a different view. Not that it's all successful, but the idea of lobbying, if you really want to do it, not only takes money, it takes an amazing amount of effort. But anyway, her views, she's very pro-Israel, but now she's, over the last 2 years with the war going on, she's evidently not all that happy with the way they've carried out things in Gaza. So her views have kind of changed, which is interesting. Because now she's very concerned about humanitarian aid to Gaza, as he sees all the bodies and arms and legs. But, it, you know, people change, don't they, in their views? But anyway, my point here, which I never get to, it seems, is when you look at the, like, healthcare and economic policy, none of the questions they ask her on their opinions are the stuff we talk about. It has to do with healthcare. She favors a public option that would allow individuals to buy into Medicare or other government health insurance over Medicaid. I don't know how that would even work, but it has nothing to do with what we talk about, which is cost. And hey, I'm jumping you with this. I should have sent it to you. You ever heard of a alternative funding plan for when it comes to medical stuff? I'll explain it to you because I just saw this article, Kevin. I'm sorry. They're talking about how the Department of Homeland Security is now investigating these groups. Remember I told you about the lady downstairs in the bar with the brain surgery here, and the guy did the wrong thing, and it was 150 grand.
Wound up in Japan.
It turns out now that there's organized groups here, growing by the day, evidently, that will, if you have something that's like a cancer, or if you've got a multiple sclerosis or something like that. I actually know somebody who went to Mexico for a multiple sclerosis treatment. She couldn't get it here, and now she's fine. She couldn't get it here. It was either Mexico or Russia. It's like 20 or 30 grand or something. But anyway, these groups are now offering companies. They're saying, okay, Ivy Tech has somebody who has multiple sclerosis. Okay, instead of sending a hospital here and running up bills, they're actually going to pay for you to go to wherever it is, Caymans or someplace, to get the treatment. Now, evidently, they must be getting put up to it by the drug companies. They're all worried about people getting the wrong stuff, and is it safe? Now, they're investigating all these companies instead of investigating the people that are charged 100 grand for not doing the right job. What's wrong with this picture? Not saying they're all clean. I'm just, you know where I'm coming from with this.
Not just, you know, investigating them for their pricing schemes and so on, but for pushing so hard on things that just don't help.
Yeah.
And in fact, in many cases, things that that will kill you. So, yeah, it's a completely bleeped up industry. We've spent a lot of time on this on this show. I know I have. I know Carl has, and you, and so we, you know, and even Lou with some of his litigation that's involved in there. So, we don't need to beat that horse today.
No, I do know one thing. I will say, Kevin, out of all the statements I've heard in my life, the dumbest one has to be, here's Xanax. By the way, don't take Xanax if you're allergic to it. How the hell do you know if you're allergic to it until you take it?
Yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you for that. Anyway, what So what's up? Why is the market in the crapo?
Before you get away from that, you did mention Wikipedia, and you and I had a little bit of a disagreement about that before. Here's what Wikipedia is good for. If you want to go up, let's see, who died recently? Diane Keaton passed away, about a week ago. If you want to go in and look up Diane Keaton in there, find out how old she was, find out, was she married, who'd she marry, if you want a list of all the movies she was in, it's fine for that. But when it comes down to, you know, fair representations of anything significant, any significant positions, that kind of stuff, it is a totally unreliable source. It's kind of open to, and I think I shared with you the Cheryl Atkinson report on it, about how they, you know, how people get shut out, how people get, and others are favored in terms of how they update it. And, you know, if you ever want to use it as a starting point to just get a few basics about somebody or about some event, it's fine, but you better go find better sources.
Oh, I agree. I don't think I disagreed with you.
And my point would be, if I ever had a student turn in a paper citing Wikipedia as a source, and I'm sure Russell would tell you the same thing, I'm sure Hal would tell you the same thing. If we all had a student turning that in as a primary source for information, we would be bouncing it right back to them.
I know it's sort of contributory, isn't it? People can contribute some kind of word.
Open, except that there are people who have more control than others, and so somebody goes in and puts in an accurate update, that it immediately is gone.
Who puts in the basic stuff? Their staff?
Pretty much, yeah. They got people who start, and it's built up a lot of information over the years, but it's not a reliable source for anything substantive.
Well, I was just, with this particular case, I was just looking at the depth of the questions on people's positions, and let's just say they're nowhere near as deep as we go into them here.
Yeah, and if you ever, look up anything on there, then, the next step is to say, okay, I better go find, let me take that and run some sources, because you will have a lot of stuff that you can't confirm.
Oh, I usually use it just like what you're talking about. When did somebody, what movies people are. I know it's somewhat contributory, and they're always asking for money, too. Is it a non-profit, or is there nobody owns it, or how does that work? Because they're always asking you to send
them. I don't know what the corporate structure is on it, but it's... it's a free source, and sometimes you get what you pay for, you get your money's worth.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of which, you were texting me yesterday about we're talking to Larissa, Dr. Demiak, on Wednesday regarding the professor seats that are endowed professorships, and you were saying that the football, basketball, how's that all going to change when they sell half of it to a public
private
company.
Equity firm? Yeah, that'll be interesting. I don't know, but yeah, you guys were talking about endowed professorships, and I said, hell, look, head football coach, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, many of the sports you never hear about even have endowed coaches' positions. That's just the way colleges roll, man.
Well, Kevin, how do you price that crap? I mean, when I say this, when I was at the University of Chicago, it was pretty simple. That was a long time ago. So say you wanted to pay your dude $100,000 a year, which in those days probably you did. Maybe that was too high, actually. The interest rate was, let's say, 8. Or say it was 10. You gave him $1 million, you got your professorship. Well, how much what do you got to give him now? And interest rates were like 0 for a while.
Well, plus you have to pay for the buyout.
The buyout,
after you fire them.
Well, I'm talking about a regular professor.
I wonder if that's endowed. That would be the ultimate, wouldn't it? You know, the endowed buyout fund for the guy you have to fire.
So you're saying that when somebody hires, LSU hires Kelly for $8 million a year, let's say the interest rate is 5%, which is kind of high. I guess if you're in the market the last few years, not so much today and yesterday, What does that get you? $8 million a year is well, 10% would be $80 million, right? So it's $160 million.
Yeah.
You got to give $160 million for 1 year, right? 5% of that is eight.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
so
if it's parked there and it's just yielding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you have to. That's what they used to do. It would actually go out with a 10-year. I don't know how far out they went, Kevin. They went out as far as they could, I think. I mean, in those days, you could buy a 30-year bond, for God's sake, and there you had it. So, I mean, in other words, if you wanted to pay Milton Friedman $100,000 a year, you could put $1 million into a 30-year government bond. There you go. It was that simple. Well, so now how do you do it if, like you say, your fixed income is way less than that, which means it's like a real lot of dough. I don't think anybody's come up with $160 million for Kelly, do you? But, do you think you're going to make 15% in the market? Good luck with that. I mean, some years, yes, some years, maybe not so much. And then, yeah, you're right. What happens if you buy them out? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I think that usually they usually wind up getting a bunch of people, a bunch of their BSDs who come in and they're they'll put together a fund. I have no I don't know the mechanics of that. Don't really care.
Well, it is curious because, I mean, like I said, it used to be very simple. I mean, for those who don't know what the hell I'm talking about, 30-year bonds at one point, I think the top tick was like 12.8%, Kevin, when I started. It's a real number. So the bond itself, for those that don't know, when you look at a 30-year bond or a 10-year bond, there is actually a bond that is that bond. Okay, so when they talk about the 30-year, there is a bond that is traded. In those days, it was an 8.5% bond, and I was a Board of Trade member at the time, so every month, for delivery, every 3 months, I would get this big hunk of stuff in the mail. But how many people have that particular bond to be delivered, right? Even if you did have the bond or wanted to take delivery. So there would be, QSIP number XXXX0000 that is the real bond. Well, if you got 0001 and it's paying 4%, you could deliver that bond, but you had to deliver 100.001% of them, or 0.99% of them. It's pretty complicated. But anyway, the bond that was traded was an 8.5% bond. So when the market rate goes to 12.5, I think the bottom tick on the bond, that bond, Kevin, was 66 cents on the dollar. So that's how you got to the 12.5%. You paid less for the 8.5% bond. I think most of our listeners by now will understand what I'm talking about. That bond traded 66.5. But anyway, my point is, if you wanted to endow Milton Friedman for the next 30 years, all you had to do is buy $1 million of those bonds, and he was getting paid $100,000 a year for the next 30 years. That's how easy it was. Now I think it's, without the buyouts, it's a hell of a lot more complicated. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, so the likelihood, especially when you're paying that kind of money, what do you suppose the likelihood, if you were to really do it as a proper financial equation, you want to put together the proposal to make the offer in the first place, and you figure the likelihood of having to pay a buyout within a certain number of years, you start doing, testing those different scenarios, what would you really have to pay up front?
I'm thinking it'd be like $200 million.
50% likely? Is it 10% likely? You start doing that. I could put together the spreadsheet for you.
Well, yeah, you can do it, but I think it'd be $200 million.
Change this variable, and here's what you got.
What off the top of your head, because you're our expert.
Maybe I should do that, and it wouldn't exactly be genius material, but I'll bet you I could probably get some athletic director to pay for that.
Well, what seems interesting, Kevin, as I was rattling off. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but I was talking about the revenue in college sports versus pro, and what is interesting is the revenue on the Bears was about $700 million, and the revenue on Notre Dame is like $220 million or something. Yet the coach on the Bears doesn't make four times as much as the coach on Notre Dame. Apparently he makes the same, everybody doesn't even make double. Does he even make the same amount?
That's a good question. Let's just say at some places, you know, what was Nick Saban making when he was at Alabama? He was probably making...
I thought he was like five.
But, you know, I'm not sure what Marcus Freeman is earning right now. I'm sure he's getting a raise because people keep raising his name for some of these other high-profile jobs that are open. If he's... As a first-time head coach, you know, what was he likely to have been making when they hired him a couple of years ago versus what he's going to get now are two different things.
I'll bet he's already been bumped. But I'm saying, what would you, off the top of your head, of the last guys that have gotten a, say, 8 to 10 year contract, what percentage of them have made it all 8 to 10 years? It can't be half, is it? Can't be half.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't know what the average number of years are, but I would say there is. Even if it's not the highest of the high-profile guys, DeVore at Alabama seems to be on solid footing now after a suspect start. You know, the start that had all the big fans. The Alabama fans rumbling a little bit his first year or two, but when you talk about the coaches that get more in the $4 and $5 million range, they probably are getting bought out at some point.
Well, how can I say this politically correctly? I honestly believe there is no such thing as a stupid human being, because everybody knows something that we don't, Kevin. I don't think there is such a thing. But collectively, people can be really stupid. And with some sort of whatever drive people have, if you look at where this professional stuff is going, I mean, look at the pros right now. Look at the NFL. There isn't an undefeated team, is there? I think the Patriots have one loss, and everybody else got two at least, don't they? I'm not positive, but I think they do. Now in college, you're going to end up with sort of the same thing. You end up with 35 teams, 40 maybe, and somewhere along the line, you're going to end up not playing sidewash state and beating them up 60-0, because people are going to say, wait a minute, a $40 million payroll team can't be playing somebody with no payroll. It's like playing a park district team, for God's sake. Somehow we're going to see, if this trend continues, we're going to see that stop, I think. Now, this is just me looking forward. I'm pretty good at that. I can't tell you the timing, but now if that stops and they all start playing each other kind of a lot, nobody's going to go, they're not all going to go 12-1. The math just isn't there, is it, if you keep playing each other?
Well, to a certain degree, that's coming to fruition now, because yeah, you're going to see probably multiple two-loss teams in their playoffs scenario, and, you know, that's different. That, you know, used to be, you get that second loss, you were done. Your season was over.
But also, if you add on to that, there is nobody, well, maybe it's a little too strong of a statement, I think there's just about nobody that you can point a finger at and say, this guy is a success in today's world, because today's world starts every year now. Well, give me a guy who is a success, but he also has a general manager now. He's got a bunch of people that don't really work for him that are snagging people off the portal. Kids are showing up that he never even met. Name me anybody who you could say is good at this, because this just showed up.
Yeah, and I'm thinking as you go, as you discuss it, is who really has mastered it, and that's a good question.
How do you master it when it changes every week?
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying, where it changes every week, but, you know, there are people that figure it out. Let me give you a different example from a few years ago. Remember when we started to see the one-and-done basketball players?
Yeah.
And there were two people that mastered it immediately, that really adapted quickly. One of them was Calipari when he was at Kentucky.
Yep.
And so he not only loaded up on them, but he figured out how to coach them so that you get a bunch of freshmen who would come in. None of them really had a clue about how to play team basketball. He didn't do anything complicated, but they just drilled and drilled and drilled to do basic, to play basic team defense, to run an offense, and then to let the talent go. And I don't know that, I can't remember him winning a national championship that way.
But he came real close.
Yeah, but he was close. He was a Final Four contender every year, and they put a lot of good players into the NBA. But he had a model, and so if you could catch Kentucky in December, you could beat them. If you had to catch Kentucky in late February, that you were pretty much going to lose. And so he was good at that. The other one who was really good at it was Krzyzewski at Duke. And Duke is still really good at it, with John Shire as the coach. They get them, and they have a different approach to how they coach and to what they run for an offense. But they are really good at getting in these guys, and they always have a few veterans. Their model is a little bit different. They don't have wholesale one-and-dones. They always have a few of those veterans that are not as highly regarded as players, but they kind of keep, they're the glue to the whole thing. And then they always have three or four guys who are, they're not planning to stick around more than a year, and they make it work. So that's an example of people adapting, and they adapted quickly. They kind of...
Well, didn't they have to sort of unadapt when those guys could go play in the Florida League and didn't have to go to college?
Well, I don't think so. Calipari, they just got tired of him at Kentucky, so now he's at Arkansas. That was a little bit different situation. I don't think Duke ever had to unadapt, because there's enough guys who are going to come to college. Because remember, you can do like, Matas Bruzelis of the Bulls did, and you can go play that one year in the G League and get paid. And that's great, but you're still not getting the same basketball experience. You'll play more games, you'll get, pro-style coaching. There's a lot to be said for that as an option, especially if you really don't want to be in college, you don't want to do all the class stuff.
Pro-style coaching, watch the Bulls, tell me they're coached at all.
The Bulls?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they are.
By who? It looks to me like I've seen playground games more organized.
Oh, I disagree. I think the Bulls are playing a really interesting style of basketball right now. That in the past, when they had to rely on a couple of different, like a Zach LaVine or somebody like that, wasn't a bad guy or anything like that, but he was a guy who had to have the ball and had to put up a volume of shots. Right now, if you sit down and watch the Bulls, they're moving the ball, they're sharing it, they get a lot of guys into double figures. And they're playing a very, very good style of basketball. And, this is what they hired Donovan to do when they hired him a long time ago, because that was his style at Oklahoma City before he was with the Bulls.
Well, when they're winning, which they were, I'll agree with you. The last few games I've watched where they're losing, they totally break down into Ole defense and run down and throw it up.
Well, part of the effect on offense is that the guy who has the ball, Josh Giddey, has been out.
Well, that's true. But Duke still has.
But they're sort of
the Notre Dame of college. I mean, they can get the best for the one and duns, because guys, I mean, your parents would rather have you go to Duke than Arkansas, for God's sake. I would think.
Although I'm not prepared to look down my nose at Arkansas.
No, me neither. Me neither. I'm just
good education. But the Duke is kind of the national brand type of thing. So
yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for the pedigree, but there's also a lot to be said for part of your basketball experience is you're playing in big games, you're playing in front of packed arenas, you have a chance for that the NCAA experience where you get into the regionals, and the regional finals are a big deal, and the place is full. And if you can make it to the Final Four, it's a big event. There's a whole...
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't you love to be part of that?
It still exists that as a basketball player, and as an athlete of any kind, I would find that real cool to be part of that.
God, yeah.
And so, I think the colleges still have that to sell. It's not going to be for everybody. And so that G League alternative is a nice thing to have, and it's especially
do they get any crowds for that?
Don't want to be bothered with going to school at all. I was reading about the Notre Dame Eastern Illinois game that they played, and they started off, they were kind of lackluster when they played against a team that they should have beaten by a lot and ultimately did. And they had guys showing up from class, you know, missed the shoot around because they were in class. They had Tuesday classes that day, and they missed the shoot around right before the game. And then when they were showing up just about the time to throw their uniforms on and run out with everybody for layup line. So it sort of depends on the school and the inclination. But if you don't want to be bothered with that kind of stuff, go to the G League. You know, that's what you should do. And you know, college isn't for everybody, especially at 18 years old. College isn't for everybody. I sure as hell didn't have the maturity to be a real serious student at that time.
Oh, sure you were. I remember. You sure you were?
I missed a lot of. I cut a lot of classes.
I never was a class cutter because I had nothing else to do. I mean, we know somebody who did, but I mean. At 10 in the morning, everybody else goes to class. You sit in your room. What do you do? I mean,
I slept.
Well, okay. I was...
Because I was up late the night before.
I don't know. I just always said, going to class, I never thought it was that big of a deal because, it was 3 hours a day and you had nothing else to do. I mean, whatever. I mean, anyway, so if we were... G League, is that in Florida or is that Atlanta?
I was going to say, graduate school was there for the enriching educational experience.
Oh yeah, is it G League get any crowds?
Not really.
So, but if we were, where is it? Is it in Atlanta or in Florida?
There's places where it's popular. So, you know, for instance, you know, Fort Wayne, not too far from here. Fort Wayne has a pretty good following, but I don't. You know, I think when we say a pretty good following, maybe they get a couple thousand people for every game.
Okay. Well, didn't it start out as a group that just played in like one city in Atlanta or Florida or somewhere? I thought the first year or two they were just in one city.
No, the history of the G League. Sorry.
Well, okay. So,
I just don't. If you ask me, I have no idea how it started out.
All right. We have one more shot on the veteran stuff coming. Diane Kelly's going to be on Monday.
Good.
What's the make of all that, Kevin? Seems to me everything we talk about seems a tad unorganized. I mean, what do you do when somebody leaves? I mean, I thought Hal, obviously we had tremendous work with Talia and Dr. Mark and other people, but I thought Hal really interspersed some stuff that was unique to the whole thing about, yeah, they let me out. Did he even get a plane ticket? I mean, they let him out in Washington, and who was it yesterday? It was when Wayne said when he mustered out, they said, by the way, where's the home? He goes, well, my parents don't live there anymore. What am I going to do, knock on the door and say this used to be my house? I mean, it's got to be, I can't even.
Have you broken down my bedroom yet?
Yeah. So then we had Hal and Wayne talking about the guys that just got, basically tossed out. Now, I know when Mark Johnson got tossed out, he was a PhD, you know, so it was a little different. But I mean, did they immediately send you up for unemployment? I mean, at least Wayne said that he had all this leave time built up, so he actually got paid for 3 months. But what if you didn't? You just walk out, here you go, there's the Greyhound bus station, have a nice life. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I suspect that there are probably some resources, and I don't know this, and it would be a good question. You know, this would be one back for Mike. That if you don't advocate for yourself, then you know there's things you aren't going to get. But I find it a little hard to believe. Maybe it's true that there aren't opportunities for you to plan your transition. There probably are some resources, whether it's effective. Whether it is, well worthwhile, I don't know. I do know, but for instance, you just take, what we do at Ivy Tech. We get a lot of veterans who come in and they're using their VA benefits for education. Probably I get some where we are up in South Bend and Elkhart. Indianapolis has a ton. So, it's a big deal, and we have a lot of veterans who are on faculty and are department chairs and so on. So especially in Indianapolis. In fact, you know, I can think of three in Indianapolis that are you know, really fairly high level, you know, vets, and so they're very committed to supporting other vets. And there's a lot of stuff that they may have done in the military, depending on what they were. And you talked about this a little bit. If you're you know, infantry, you know, how much stuff do you have that will translate to college credit?
Well, Mike said those guys are either mercenaries or security.
Well, could be, but you know, but if you're security, you can come back and study criminal justice,
right?
Get some credentials there, and you know, and build a career in law enforcement if you want, for example. So you know, there still are opportunities, but if you're in logistics, obviously, then a lot of what you do translates into the various supply chain fields, and that includes things like, you know, if you're in procurement. I mean, we actually have. In our supply chain group, and I was involved in developing this several years back, we have a credentials in a Department of Defense logistics program. So not only do you take some of our standard courses, but you also do coursework in how the federal procurement system works, how federal budgeting works, how what they call our RMNA, which is their inventory management process. We have specific courses for those, and so if you want to work as a civilian on a base, or if you want to work for a defense contractor, it's a good credential to have. So you know, there are plenty of opportunities out there for people who want to pursue a career either, you know, tangent to the military, or in things that will utilize the skills that they did develop while they were in the military. There are opportunities, and I find it hard to believe that the military itself just pushes people out the door without providing opportunities. Whether people take advantage of those opportunities or not is another issue.
Well, I think that it would have to happen while you were there, because I'm just thinking about the return of one of the guys who helps out with the show, go nameless. He's between jobs, and he just sold his condo because the building was getting all screwed up. But I mean, he would have been happy to stay there, but some guy was buying them all, so he didn't want to be the last guy. Evidently, if somebody owns over like 80% of the condos in a building, the other 20% can't get a mortgage, Kevin, or some bizarre stuff like that. So he pretty much got out while the getting was good. So he's got some cash. Well, he goes to between jobs, and he goes to get an apartment, and they go, oh, no, if you're not making three times the rent, it can show us, like, you know, four paychecks, you can't even make an application. So I guess what I'm saying, I know that Ivy Tech and obviously Columbia takes people in the GI Bill from what Telly was talking about. I know that this can all happen, but as you know, I don't know, they drilled it into me someplace, maybe at Pullman. It's all about the process. Now, if somebody, I think somebody from the Army or Navy or Air Force Marines will land at Ivy Tech. I'm just real curious about the 3 months before. If somebody says, I know I'm getting out, it's now November, I know I'm getting out January 1st. Okay, I'm questioning them, and you're not the person at Ivy Tech. Is that person making an application for the January 2nd start? Does he know he's going to live in the area, he or she? Do they have an apartment, or do the parents happen to live there? Or a brother, we can crash for 3 months. There's a lot of stuff here that has to happen for that guy or lady to be in your class and know where they're going to go. Because there has to be a job someplace, unless there's unemployment. I can't imagine putting, unless the military really does this in the month or two before you're out. And it sounded from like hell, and the ship just landed and off he went. It doesn't sound like he was doing that from the Persian Gulf in the 93 degree water. I'm wondering that 3 months. I mean, what would you say the average time is if they just dump somebody? It's a terrible word. If they just dump somebody before he ends up in your class, it's got to be 3 months and a place to live and, you know, other stuff.
And that's a good question. I've had vets in my classes, but I've never had that conversation with them, so I don't know the answer.
How come every time somebody talks about stuff, all I do is come up with more questions? It's a very bad habit. Just saying. What do you think?
You know, and point being, you know, one of my takeaways from this, because still providing the educational opportunities is great, but Larissa was pretty clear about this, you know, and she spoke to it. What about other issues related to the transition? Some of the mental health issues.
Oh yeah.
People tend to stay silent, and it doesn't get raised. And you know, I'm sitting here looking at our menu of stuff, and we have a whole team of people called Ivy Cares that, you know, because our students, you know, we have a lot of people who were raised below poverty line. There's a lot of things that we deal with. And so that group will do anything from getting you a loan or laptop because you can't afford a laptop to do your work, to, you know, helping people with things like criminal record expungements and stuff like that. So then mobilizing some psychology benefits and things like that. So that, you know, they exist. And we even run food banks and things like that because we have students who, you know, they need some assistance with, you know, just to put a meal on the table for their kids. So we've got, you know, all kinds of support because our mission is, we take a whole lot of people who aren't your typical students that if you went to Indiana or Purdue or Notre Dame, where, you know, most of those students, they have nothing to do but be a full-time student, and generally they're younger, they don't have families, they don't have jobs, some will be doing some work, but, our profile is different. My students have families, they have jobs, they may have full-time jobs, they may have part-time jobs, and then they're going to school. And so how we go about supporting them and getting them through and being able to provide, you know, some extra support and maybe some grace when they need it. Nobody gets a pass, but some people need to get some grace from you. And we get them through, and we, you know, try to get them to the point where now they have the educational background to have a better life. That's what we do. But I don't know that we have anything that resembles the kinds of services that some vets need. So one of the things that I will be doing in the next few weeks is taking some of the stuff from our shows, you know, trimming it down to just the stuff that we're discussing now, and I'm going to get it in the hands of our chancellor and say, you know, where should we be going with this, and see what we do, because I think it's really important. It's one thing to be able to say, I can get you some logistics credentials, or I can get you a business degree or something like that you need. It's quite another to say, I can do that and get you the support that you need to help make that transition.
Kevin, it seems like, and we had so much other stuff to talk about, but I mean, our alma mater we talk about, but I mean, Notre Dame has, unbeknownst to most people, actually has a seriously active ROTC program. It's not like Texas A&M, but it's you know, there's all four of them are there, right? At least they were when I was there. And I never once saw anybody 25 years old in the GI Bill sitting in a class. I'll tell you, I was talking about Columbia. There's all kinds of people there. I mean, there are some places specialize in that, how does that work?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer specifically. I do suspect that, you know, whether it's a higher end school like Columbia or whether it's a community college, there probably are places where vets will gravitate, whether it just happened organically or whether, you know, a specific school has a lot of programming built around their situation. Hard to say, you know, did people just start gravitating there? Is it because, it's in New York and there's a lot of critical mass there? I don't know how Columbia got to be that way. Everybody will support GI Bill. Everybody has financial aid experts on staff who will be able to help you navigate that, everything that you have to do to make that work for you. But whether they have the other support systems that that apply specifically to vets is another issue. Well, remember, to me, the whole thing is you build around student success. I don't want you just enrolled. I want you to succeed. And while it you know, it requires self-discipline, and there is a, you know, I'm not exonerating students of any responsibility for their own success, but you know, we don't do any good if we just sign people up and they take a few courses and they get discouraged because they're either not successful or they're just not adapting well to it, and so they fall by the wayside and they don't complete. And in Indiana, and I don't know how other states work because I've never worked in education in another state, but in Indiana, the funding for the school is built very much around not just enrollment, but around completions, around successful completions for the students. Now, there's a risk to that, and the risk is, okay, if we just funnel everybody through, then they all get their completions, and they're patted up, and we pat them on the back, and we pat ourselves on the back for doing it, and yet we're cranking out people who aren't well educated. So, you know, it's not a perfect funding model, but it is the funding model. It's the one that we have, and it's the one that, you know, at least the message is generally heard from my experience, that everybody understands that that doesn't mean that you're letting people go, sort of like the public schools will tend to do in a lot of areas where they just pass them along. That's not what we're doing.
It's not tend to do, that's what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. You worry about that. You always worry about, you know, the perverse, the incentives that, you know, that cause you to do what you shouldn't do. They're intended for one thing, they cause something else. So you always worry about those, but what I'm saying is, in Indiana, that is a big emphasis, and that's the same funding model that Russell's got, that I do. You know, Russell has it at IU, I have the same thing at community college.
Well, you know, I wonder about when my stepfather got out of the Army in 45 or whatever, I think a lot of people then went to DePaul. They all got accounting degrees and stuff. The dude from the died a few weeks ago. I forget his name, unfortunately. The guy was 100 years old. Tuskegee Airmen guy. Obviously a black guy. But, Tuskegee. He went to NYU, didn't he? I believe. It seems like New York maybe is more open to. And I can't imagine Notre Dame saying no.
They're never going to say no, and they will actually, they'll work with people on how the financial aid situation works, and you know, there's all kinds of special controls on it too. I'll just give you a silly example, and this is just a little bit of a sideline. When you're taking your VA benefits, they will only pay for a limited number of online classes, and what I mean by online is the asynchronous online where you're very self-directed, and they limit the number of those that you do. Now, I can if they want to take a class that is delivered as virtual, you know, using Zoom, they can do it, and that doesn't count against their online. But if I record the class and make the recording available, then the VA is going to look at that as an online class. And so they're going to say, you're over the limit. You don't get funding for that class. And if the school is trying to pass those off as not online classes, then we could lose our ability to support students with VA benefits.
Well, you know,
so there's a lot of quirky rules to this. That's just an example of one that I have to be aware of, but I know that the people who work in the financial aid area are dealing with all kinds of other rules that they have to, and that's not just for VA, it's for every kind of financial aid.
What we're really good at is
sending students out, sending our graduates out without debt.
I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of the school. If you're 25 and you have a job and maybe you have a family, you're probably not going to go to Notre Dame or Duke. You're gonna be in a big city kind of place where you can actually have a job. You're probably not gonna go to some. You're probably gonna go more to Columbia than you are to Cornell in upstate New York type of thing.
You're not going to go away to college.
Yeah, it's kind of as we wander through the various themes of the show, and a lot of it still is. And obviously you talk a lot of markets today with Carl, but. It really does seem bizarre how many people need money or help, Kevin? Doesn't that mean the stuff that's going on in the with the SNAP program. I mean, you know, whatever you feel about the politics of it, the simple fact is, the Chicago Food Depository is serving 200,000 meals a day. I mean, you know, we've also kind of tripped over the line here where we need almost like an all hands discussion. What is the relationship between taxation, government, and charity? I mean, is it a situation where if people pony up money that are already paying taxes and feeding 200,000 people a day, does the government say, you guys got it covered, we're not doing it? And yet, in other words, I don't know how that all kind of works. And the thing that has seeded this in my brain is, I wasn't a big shot, Kevin, but I was on the board of the Notre Dame Club of Chicago for a while, and my big job was to run the parties at all the Rocky dinners, which, by the way, I did a pretty good job at, because afterward people complained about what happened to us. But we'd have, Kevin, we had 7 or 8 very attractive young ladies serving drinks up in the Hyatt, what do you call the big thing upstairs, the big suite, and everybody thought, God, who are these guys? But it was an organization, you know, we did it. Anyway, the bottom line is the Notre Dame Club of Chicago has a love-hate relationship with Notre Dame. It's the biggest club. There's more people here. They raise the most money. But they don't give it to Notre Dame. And Notre Dame is always pissed off about that because all the other clubs raise the money and just hand them the dough. Chicago says, no, we're not doing that. We're going to use this for scholarships for kids from Chicago that want to go to Notre Dame. Now, I don't know if that's their big theme anymore. I haven't been there in 20 years. But so Notre Dame would sit down with, you know, young Kevin O'Neill. He'd say, okay, here's the deal, your parents, blah, blah, blah. Well, you got to pay $10,000 a year. And the kid's going, okay, that's the formula, but I still can't make it. Well, our friend Craig Fowler and another guy, what the hell's his name? He owned a big real estate firm here. They would interview like 50 kids. And if they interviewed the family and they'd say, okay, this kid's $2,000 away from actually really being able to go, Notre Dame Club of Chicago would pony up the $2,000. And this worked for a while, for years. Until all of a sudden, Notre Dame decided, we'll really fix these guys. If they come up with the $2,000, we're pulling back $2,000. So that's where I got my weird feeling about when charities do good stuff, it's really good, but that just means somebody else doesn't have to do anything. And the interplay... Well, go ahead. I'm talking about.
I'm sorry. I want to cut you off. Finish the thought, because.
Well, I'm saying so. There's a lot. There's a lot to that. I mean, there's 40 million people that are on food stamps. I think it's more descriptive than SNAP. And there's probably another 10 that qualify and are either too proud or don't know they qualify. So I mean, there's a real lot of people that don't make enough money to feed themselves at the current prices, which are only seeming to be going up. I mean, it's a problem. Housing is also, and now we talk about, you know, vets. What about the help they need? It seems like everywhere we touch, Kevin, there's areas that need help, isn't it?
Yeah. So here's just a couple of basic parameters. First of all, if we're going to do stuff with government is, I would like to say, at least in theory, government is limited by their ability to tax. So they can only tax you so much, which is sort of true.
Yeah.
They do find new and creative ways to tax us, but okay, there's got to be some theoretical limit to how much they can tax, and therefore some theoretical limit to how much they can spend, which we're also not seeing. But let's just live in the theoretical world for that for a minute. Not-for-profit or charitable organizations are totally limited by the amount of contributions they can raise, and that's finite as well. If you can address some of these problems in a for-profit model, then, and in a profitable way, that's how you really have to solve the problems. And we as a society need to be looking for more of these, although there are some pretty interesting ones happening now. I'll give you a couple of examples. There is a company in the Chicago area called Aspiritech. It was started by a couple whose son was on the autism spectrum. He had Asperger's. Smart kid, had a college degree, but never could hold down a job because he just couldn't fit any workplace, any professional workplace. So they wanted to start a company where he could be where he could thrive. And they did a lot of investigation, and they settled on software testing, you know, contract software testing for large corporations who are, you know, rolling out big software projects. And why did they choose that? It's because people who are autistic are really good at focusing for long periods of time, and they're very detail-oriented, which is just what you need for software testing. Well, that company, last I looked, was up to about 125 employees.
Wow.
And they were making money doing it and solving a social problem of how do you provide employment for people on the autism spectrum. Different example.
You mentioned, is somebody... I know there's a big, long spectrum here. There's nonverbal, there's all kinds of stuff. But is autism on a functional scale kind of the same as Augsburger when you're dealing with the person, or are they totally different?
I am not expert in the disease, so you heard what I discussed on the business model. I can't get in any deeper in that. I just don't know.
When I see somebody like at some of the Walmarts, you'll see somebody who clearly is something like that, but I can't tell you which one they are. I mean, or even if there is that much of a difference. I mean, I know that Tommy's comes on the show once in a while for us. His son is totally nonverbal. That he's way on the scale. I mean, there are people, people who have Augsburgers that are in college.
They may also be totally capable of sitting down and trying to break a website.
Yeah.
When someone's rolling out new web software, and therefore he's able to make a living and support himself. So, that's the point of addressing this in a for-profit model. Here's a different example. Walgreens. They started with a distribution center in South Carolina, and I know they've rolled this out at a lot of other places now. They built out their all their process, all of their computer systems, and they designed all of the processes within the warehouse for distribution so that they could have people who have no handicaps whatsoever and people with an assortment of handicaps, and they could work side by side with equal productivity. Put a lot of work into how this happens, but the point is this. They had it was roughly a 50-50 split of people with very various kinds of handicaps and people who don't. And it could be sight impairment, it could be speech and things like that that were problems. There were a lot of physical disabilities that they could deal with in terms of how they laid out workstations and so on. And the point is this: why is this work in a for-profit model? Because turnover is really, really expensive. That when you come in day one, your productivity is zero or near zero, and your productivity goes up based on based very much on your time in the job. So as you gain experience, you get more and more productive until there's some limit to how productive a person can be. So when anybody leaves your organization, you replace them with that, you replace a productive person with a zero productive person. And when you have high turnover, that means you have a lot of zero productivity people and not, way more than you want. And that's where the cost of turnover comes in. That's the real cost, and it's really, really hard to measure. But that's the big cost. And I think if you drew that on a curve and understood that, everybody would get it. When you have the best place for people with handicaps, people with disabilities to work, they don't leave you. So when you build your process so that they can be just as productive as the people who don't have disabilities, you have at least half of your workforce is not going to leave you. You increase your productivity, you cut your turnover rate, you increase your productivity, you make money, and you solve a problem.
Kevin, do you think any of this... I mean, you don't know the answer to this, but you think anything's going to change now that Walgreens has been taken private, and the first thing they did was cut everybody's paycheck?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I know they did build out a whole lot more of their distribution centers like that, and that they had a lot of other companies in trying to copy what they were doing. So, and that's why I said there are some really interesting things happening in the world like that. We need to have more. because this is how you get less reliant on government and on government funding all these NGOs that siphon off all kinds of funds, because, you know, it looks like we're doing some real good by funding this NGO, only to find out that it's really just sucking our money and lining pockets. If the more we can move into a for-profit model, and
I don't know how you're going to do that serving dinners, but
folks are saying that's the big thing, but it is a thing right now. And the more we can move in that direction, the better off we're going
to
be.
Well, somewhere along the line, if you're, I need to get your thoughts on the Irish tomorrow. Plus, for those that don't know, we've talked on the show. Carl, pile in if you want. For those who don't know, if we've talked about the two, there's been two major betting scandals, in the last 3 weeks, Kevin?
Yeah. Yep.
And yesterday, the CME announces they're going to allow you to do sports betting on the exchange now. What are they missing?
I have no idea. I don't even know what they're trying to accomplish with that. I mean, the article you sent says. Yeah. They're not going to do it in states where there's legal betting, because they're not going to compete with that, and they're not going to get licensed to compete with that. But I have no idea why that's a good idea.
If there's a dollar out there, you know, they got to chase it. I mean, it's pretty scary. This is the fourth time I'm going to be saved by betting, Kevin. The first time was. We always had racetracks, and everything else was illegal in Illinois. And then we went from what was next? Was the lottery?
Yeah, it was the lottery.
Then we're going to be saved by that. Yeah, and then we said, okay, that's not enough. Then we had off track betting, right? And that we're going to be saved there. And then we're going to have some casinos. We're going to be saved there. Then there's a Chicago casino. We're going to be saved here. And oh, by the way, now we're going to steal all the money from the casinos and put them in every bar, where the state is the casino and not the casino. So now this is what, number six? This is now sports betting. And we're all going to be saved, and yet the taxes are twice what they were when they started this whole mess. Or is it just me? Just saying.
Orwell had the doublespeak down pretty good, didn't he?
Yeah. What's the next thing going to be? We're going to bet on who buys the... In every restaurant, we're going to have cameras saying who buys the next round or what? There's got to be something. We got to find these amazing ways to take money from somebody. What would you do if you had all these investors and you put this money up at a casino, and 2 years later, the idiot said, "Oh, by the way, you don't have to go to the casino. You can have slot machines in every bar and restaurant surrounding the casinos." How much can you screw the guy? I don't get it. Why people put up with it?
That's interesting, and yet casinos thrive. So
I don't think they thrive as much.
You've built a betting culture in this country that people just love. I'm not a gambler. In any way, I don't bet on anything. So I don't get it. Casinos are kind of lost on me. Every time I've been in one, they're kind of lost. You know, and my MO as it would relate to a casino would be. I'll go to the sports book and sit down and watch games, and I probably won't place many bets there either, if any. So I'm probably the wrong guy to be commenting on.
You give somebody the golden pencil, and then the minute the guy pays you for it, you turn around and sell the golden pencil to the guy next door. I mean, I can't believe that there's not going to be. If they have gambling in every restaurant in Chicago, that it's not going to impact the casino here. How could it not? I mean, why would you go over there when you're having dinner right here? I mean, it's certainly got to do the dinner crowd different. I mean, it's anyway. I'm saying, how many times can you sell the same product? I guess is my question. Well, of course, baseball does the same thing with, or everybody's doing it with sports. You got to have five different networks to watch the games. They sell it five different times, right?
Yeah, they resell. So yeah, well, I'll let you and Carl muse on that.
So how much you got on the Irish tomorrow? After having said that, what do you got?
I bet millions and millions of dollars.
A big sheet.
Yeah, it's their last challenging game of the year. So they better win it if they want to stay alive for the playoffs. And they should. They're playing Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's got a pretty good team. And Pittsburgh is loading up for this game. They're bringing back all the alumni, the Dan Marinos, and and Tony Dorsett and all those guys, you know, they're making a big deal out of the game, even though their coach says, oh, it's a non-conference game, so it really doesn't matter to us that much.
Oh, God.
You know, baloney.
Carl, I don't think Kevin knows the slang from the floor. How much is a big sheet, Kevin?
What's a big sheet? I don't give a sheet.
No, it's a grand. A dime is 100. Those are floor balances.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, you know.
Well, you know, it's you like what's been going on the last couple of days?
I like the fact that I got put.
Well, they're getting more and more expensive.
Yeah,
isn't that a funny thing? You know, this is fascinating because front page on CNBC's website this morning. Front page. Now, I've been talking about this for a while. People are now questioning the actual useful service life of all this AI hardware.
Carl, we're not usually wrong on the show, but collectively, but we always are early. Yeah, we're always early.
The problem is, it's not questioning. It's that people have been lying about this. Okay, they've just been lying.
If you own the stock, it's your job to get on TV and tell everybody else how good it is, so they buy it even higher.
Okay, well, guess what? Everybody loves NVIDIA, right? Everybody loves NVIDIA's CEO.
And I don't. I think he's dangerous.
Well, he's extremely dangerous, but the market loves him, right? Yeah. All right. So a few days ago, he pops up on on the usual places, and essentially is. And he's trying to play a political game here. He's saying, well, if the United States loses this, this AI war to China, we're screwed, right? And basically, essentially, the essence of that is, oh, by the way, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
Okay, my company's screwed. Therefore, drop all those barriers and da 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 da. Okay. Several problems with this.
What he's saying is, forget the part about being an American company. If they're the winner, we're with them.
Well, yeah, but he unfortunately what he ended up doing when he made that statement was point out something that we ourselves, at the behest of the Chinese, with them pushing this, have backed ourselves into a corner that has a 10, 15, 20 year timeline on getting out of, which is energy. Because the Chinese has, of course, been all in on being just wonderful about the idea that, battery cars and solar panels and wind turbines and da-da-da. All this stuff, of course, made over there because it's an extremely dirty manufacturing process. But the undercurrent of this that no one wants to have the conversation about is that, you bought all these nice chips. You now build data centers to put the chips in, and they require electricity or they don't do any good. They're just bricks. All right. Problem. This is residential cost. Right? Industrial cost power tends to be cheaper because you commit to buy at a certain level. I mean, like I can, for example, I can go to the local utility.
Well, plus you can use it at night. You do a lot of stuff.
Well, like everything else, there's a volume discount, right? So if I go to the local electric utility here and I'm going to put up a manufacturing plant, and I tell them, okay, I'm committing to buy this many megawatt hours of power over the course of 12 months, all right, I will get a better price than per kilowatt hour than what I as a residential customer get charged. All right, duh. Now, the problems with this are, number one, there's a demand charge in there, which residential customers don't pay. There's a power factor correction charge potentially in there if my power factor is not 1.0, which residential customers don't pay. By the way, the reason that...
Yeah, but the residential customer pays $50 a month if you don't use any.
Well, so does the commercial customer. However, $50 is nothing compared to he pays for the meter too. Okay, but the thing is that like everywhere else, there's a discount for volume. right? Especially when volume is very large. And so, okay, fine. But the reality of it is this. The cost per kilowatt hour in China is half of what it is here in the United States, on average. All right? Now, why?
Now, when because you say the, when you say cost, are you talking about retail or are you talking about the production cost?
I'm talking about what the guy who wants to put up a data center or a house pays. All right? If I'm look, you know, my computer uses electricity, right? The cost of the production of the electricity, from my point of view, is irrelevant. What matters to me is the size of my bill. Now, you know, all right, you can get into the backdoor economics and, you know.
Yeah, what I'm saying, when you say it's half those, with all the currency crap going on and all the other stuff that goes on you're saying it actually is, if there was a common currency, it would be half as expensive.
Roughly, yeah. And okay. the reason is that despite all the screaming about people, them so-called leading in solar and green energy and things like this, the fact of the matter is that they have something like 300 coal-fired power plants in under construction right now.
Right, when I read that, and I'm not trying to be hard, I'm trying to clear this up. The three power plants that were coal in Chicago that went down and they needed fixing to be, you know, more modernized. If they had put the money in there, where does the cost of electric in those plants, assuming you put the couple hundred million dollars there you needed to, since they were so damn old, where does that rate with a natural gas facility? Where does that rate from
So this is where it gets complicated, okay? This is the classic 80-20 problem in economics. It applies virtually, essentially everywhere. Same problem that we have with medicine and things like this. I do, by the way, we can get into a little bit of that too, because there's another article that just popped up
Did you hear this thing I was talking about earlier with people paying for people to go offshore now? They're investigating that.
Right. That's what I was talking about. Yeah. That's the article that. So by the way, we'll get to that, but I want to focus on this energy thing for a minute. So here's the basic problem that you have. If you want to clean up most of a coal-fired power plant's emissions, most of it is quite reasonable to do in terms of expense. Okay, it's not really all that hard.
Yeah, it didn't sound like it was that much dough for the ones here, but the one in the middle of the neighborhood, I don't think you were going to save that one, but the one of them was on a lake where nobody lived.
Yeah, but Chief, here's the problem. What the EPA has continually done, and what the government, and of course this means the government, right? Because, you know, the EPA is the government. What the government has continually done is ratchet the emission standards higher. They've done the same thing with cars.
Yeah.
All right? They've done the same thing with light trucks and, you know, diesels and things like this. And the first 80% of any problem you want to solve costs almost no money to solve.
Right.
The last 20% gets exponentially more expensive.
Well, you went to the catalytic converters and the unleaded stuff that probably took you 75% of the way there, and now they've been...
Here's the thing. Yeah. The basic feedback-controlled fuel systems with an oxygen sensor, okay, so that your mixture is not overly rich, you're not dumping unburned gas into the environment, all right? Which, by the way, without that, you have to, because if you get detonation, the engine gets destroyed. So if you don't have the ability to control this on a closed loop basis, then you have to run rich on purpose. There's no way around this, because if you get on the other side of the curve, the engine gets wrecked. So you can't allow that to happen. But that plus a traditional catalyst gets you 98% of the way there, to the point that it's actually very hard with a car that is warmed up, even my old O2 Suburban sitting out the driveway, okay, which is exactly that level of sophistication. Once it's warmed up and the catalyst is functioning and it's operating closed loop, which takes a minute or so after a cold start, once that happens, it's actually very hard to kill yourself with carbon monoxide by sucking on the exhaust, because there's almost none of it there.
Right.
All right. Now, what the EPA has done, though, is gone further than that and continued to ratchet and ratchet and ratchet and ratchet.
Which costs a fortune and gets you almost nowhere.
Gets you basically nothing, and it's stupidly expensive. All right, now we've done the same thing.
It's like the V8 cutting back the six cylinders at a certain speed and those kinds of things. It's get you about a half a mile per gallon, and if it screws up, you blow your engine.
Well, not only that, but what's happened to the 6.2s, GM, we're talking about billions of dollars of losses here so far, and this fiasco is not over. In the search to meet that next 1%, all right, they have gone to both thinner oils, which by itself is not necessarily a bad thing, but it does get you a slight increase in fuel economy. The key word here being slight. However, the problem with it is it raises the manufacturing tolerance requirements to avoid having bearing failures to a degree that they've not been able to meet. And so as a result, you now have crankshaft spun crank bearings, okay, and fun stuff like this. It takes the engine out, destroys it. And it's a disaster. And part of the problem, now, can you get around this? Sure. You could take that engine apart. You could rebuild it. You could have the manufacturing tolerances improved when you did that, where GM could have done that in the first place. Well, guess what? The supply chains and the supply lines that we have here in the United States, it doesn't work. Now, does it work in some cases? Absolutely. I have a Mazda sitting in my garage that's got almost 300,000 miles on it, and it runs OW20, which is spec'd from the factory, as the correct oil for it. I've been using that exclusively. I've been changing it. Every single change has been done by me since the thing was brand new.
O20, you mean straight 20?
No, 0W20, fully right. Synthetic, okay? And that is an extremely thin oil, all right? And it consumes none. It obviously has not spun any bearings. It wouldn't be running.
You know who invented multi-viscosity oil?
No.
I think it was Phillips 66.
Okay. Well, now here's the interesting thing. There's a substantial difference between dinosaur-based, petroleum-based, fully synthetic oils and multi-vis and fully synthetic ones. And the difference is that with the old-style mineral-based oils, you use viscosity improvers to get the multi-grade range. And therefore, and those shear over time. Therefore, the narrower the span between the two numbers in those oils, the better.
Yeah.
And, however, with the fully synthetic oils, that's not true.
For those who are not, we're boring half to death, what happens is, way back in the day, when you had a certain weight of an oil, the thickness, that you would put in your engine, and in the wintertime, you'd probably put 20 weight oil in there, or else the damn thing wouldn't crank. And in the summertime, you'd put 30 weight or even maybe 40 weight in there when it was hot because it gave you more protection. So then somebody invented 10W30, where it was 10 when it was cold, and as it got warmer, it would heat, it would thicken up. But there'd be 20W30, which, you know, if you really drove your car hard, you'd probably rather use that. 10W30, and in the wintertime, sometime they'd say 5W30.
You had to change with the seasons, so you don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
But what's happened is that, you know, in this search for this last half mile gallon, all right, they've done that, and then the other thing they've done is they've gone to variable displacement oil pumps.
Because of the crash stuff, you've added weight back to the car, which takes you the opposite direction.
That hurts too, right. So you've got all these different things that conspire together, but essentially by chasing this last percent or so, what has happened is that you've destroyed the reliability. General Motors, Ford, and you know, Chrysler, 20 years ago, you basically got to the point that you had the engineering and the technology to have engines in the United States and U.S. cars that could run 250,000-300,000 miles from the factory without having to come apart. Nowadays, you're lucky if you get 100 before something serious breaks.
Something seriously will go wrong. But, you know, the...
The
Volkswagen diesel of the 80s got something like 45 to 50 miles to the gallon.
Well, Chief, my daughter has my...
this is years ago, though, Carl, that in order to make that car street legal today, in terms of safety, it would add 1,500 pounds to it.
Well, here's the thing. All right, now my daughter has that thing, Jetta Wagon.
Yeah, if you got hit with a bicycle in that thing, you were dead, pretty much.
Well, no. Now she's got my Jetta Wagon, okay, which has a diesel in it, has a TDI engine in it, indirect direct injection, but not the not common rail. And that car's got almost 300,000 miles on it. And it, the valve cover comes off to do timing.
The Jetta was the second iteration. The Rabbit had no protection
right.
at all.
Right.
It was like it was so bad.
Now this thing, on the other hand, has really excellent crash performance if it gets hit. Okay, now it'll be destroyed like all modern cars, but in terms of actually protecting the occupants, it does a really good job.
Well,
so those tests
are lies too.
Well, no, these are from people who, I mean, I'm fairly active on the TDI forum, and of course, you know, across the last 25 years, so, you know, fairly decent number of people have lost their vehicles because they've gotten in crashes. Okay,
yeah.
And some of the wreckage that people have gotten out and walked away from, it makes you just look and go,
that
car really doesn't do bad.
Yeah, you didn't have the engine and come in the front seat like in the old days, you know.
Right. So but where I was going with this whole thing with energy is that he said the quiet part out loud, okay, which is that there isn't any way. I have long maintained this entire AI craze is just stupidity, all right, on steroids. It's pets.com times 1,000. And people try to justify it by saying, well, but they have real products. Well, yes, they do have real products. NVIDIA has real products. I have one sitting in my computer that's 3 feet away from me right now. No argument. However, as a graphics card maker for people that do photo editing, video production, this is a $20 a share company, okay? And by the way, what started the craze was everybody was using their GPUs, their graphics cards, for Bitcoin mining. And that became uneconomic because people developed specific chipsets that were made for that specific purpose. And they were capable of doing the mining at a lower operating cost, less electricity. Oops, that market went poof like a fart in a church. Well, and all of a sudden,
we got a dash to break here pretty soon. Not now, but sometimes you run. There's two. Some Carl is involved in this and is incredibly knowledgeable, and I'm on the kind of the other side, the investment side. What Carl is saying, we're talking about a pretty serious company making really good stuff. Now the question is, if you valued it for what they're making on those kinds of things, you're talking about a $50 stock, but it's trading 180. It was 205. Now the question is, just because you think a stock price is too high doesn't mean the company sucks. They're two totally separate things.
Yeah, I'm not saying the company sucks.
No, I'm not saying you are. But my point is that's my concern here. But you know, before we go to break, because I want you to think about this, I want to talk about this health thing on the other side. But what is the odd part about this, Kyle? And I've been through the crash of '87. Didn't do so hot in that one. 2007. I was doing client stuff then. Our clients actually did pretty well.
I did okay in 08.
what happened? But here's why. Our protected index program, we always have a protective put, okay, in place for everybody who needs them. Other people don't want them. Some people want put spreads, but we're not giving people advice. We're talking to the person and designing a program for them. And if somebody's retired, has a concentration issue, whatever it is, if they can't lose over a certain amount, we're always going to be protected. And that's going to cost, like any insurance is going to cost.
Of course.
Maybe we're clever enough to sell calls against it in a covered right program to where we can cover some, real lucky,
and maybe
all.
And maybe you don't get called away and give a huge amount of gains.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, if that's a recent problem where if stocks trade 100 and somebody, and you'd say, well, what if we get called away at 110? They go, okay, well, now if the stocks go to 120, you know, my stock made a 20 and you lost me 10. I mean, you know, but that's a something. But anyway, the phenomenon I'm trying to get to is in 87, the volatility, didn't have a VIX back then, but the implied volatility, which is really all the VIX was at an all-time low. And in 2007, when people gave us money to put in, we had a lot of people at the time, John and I were on the score. It just so happened that a lot of people that were listening to us happened to be retiring from a lot of the business here in Chicago, and you know, they thought I was a pretty decent guy, which I am, and every month I'd have a two couples would come in and I'd get $1 million account from each one of them. And
right.
So, but now a lot of people don't have that in their 401k because they've had to use it for medicine, so they've had to help, you know, one of their kids who might have a doctor's problem, or one of their kids needed a down payment. You don't see this kind of retiring out of the blue collar people, essentially, that I was more attracted to, or right. were more attracted to me. But long story short, don't tell it. In 2007, we were Money Manager of the Year here at PTI, and the reason for that was the put premium. Everybody was so giddy about the market, the puts were dirt cheap. You couldn't give them away. Nobody right. wanted to buy them. So I said, you know, my brother Dan and I always talk about it. I go, Dan, you know, this stuff is so friggin' cheap. And the market's at all-time high. Why don't we, since it's costing us next to nothing, why don't we buy, if we buy 1,000 shares of stock, normally you'd buy 10 puts. I said, why don't we just buy 15? they're so cheap. We're covering with the calls easy. Why not just do it just in case? Because we are, sure enough, the market crashes and we're along extra puts, and the volatility goes from 11 to like 50. So we made a lot of dough on the way down. When everybody, so of course we were Money Manager of the Year. We're the only people that were up.
And, right.
But now we're different. I've had clients come in the last few months, especially with some of these stocks like the Googles of the world and those kinds of things. And now I'm sitting there going, hey guys, this volatility is like 45. I mean,
right.
I mean, you need to be protected, but good Lord, we're talking about, I mean, how many people have done this mentally, somehow or another, Carl, help me with this. Mentally, in other walks of life, people will take the cost of insurance and formulate that, well, that's how risky it must be. In other words, if you walk into a showroom and you've got a Corvette sitting there, and I'm going to say a Corvette's 90G. It might be, I've never bought one, but I think there's a lot of people listening to the show that could pony up the 90G if they wanted a Corvette. I'm not saying anybody wants a Corvette.
Right.
But as soon as you call your insurance guy and he goes, what are you doing? That's 15 grand a year. People are going to go, wait a minute. Why?
Right.
Is it if somebody dings it, does it cost that much? Is somebody going to steal it? Well, you immediately think that, you know, there must be some risk here. Or if I buy a house
right on the water.
Exactly
the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But somehow or another, people don't equate that with stock. I mean, a person who has a stock that the volatility, or even right now, the VIX today is going to be 23. If that
right.
doesn't give you a clue of what other people's view of the market is, I'm not saying they're right. But
right.
We just got two or three new accounts a couple months ago, Carl, and the people said, you know, I don't like where this market is now. It's too highly valued. I said, I can get you protection, but let me help you. It's going to cost, and I can't, there's no way I can cover this with calls.
Right.
And the answer both right. times was, go get me the protection. This was like in September. Get me the protection out to like Thanksgiving. I know what it's going to cost me. See what you can do on the calls to mitigate some of it. And then we'll talk again, which I thought was the right thing to do.
That's pretty logical.
Logical. I mean, my clients are pretty smart people. I mean, it's not just because they pick me, but they. I mean, that makes sense. But I'm sitting there. There's no way we can do this every 3 months.
Oh yeah, no. You'd end up with no money. Right.
But back in the day, you could do that. You could go out a year, and it would be like 5% of the stock, and you'd say, okay, I can make that up back on the calls easy. Or, oh, by the way, right. we think the stock's going to be up more than 5%. So it's, you know, you all, if you buy a stock and you protect it, what do you want to do? You want to lose money on your puts.
Because you want the stock
to go up, right?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, a hedge by definition is just insurance.
Yeah.
And the, you know, insurance has to be over time for most of the people a losing bet. Otherwise, there's no insurance. All right. So, I mean, you know, but the reason you buy it is because not having it is catastrophically stupid.
Right.
If something goes wrong. So, I mean, that's the whole premise of insurance. But I just...
What do you say we do a break? Because we missed the first one. Then we'll dig into the healthcare stuff, because I can't believe they're going after these people that are going offshore.
You know what was missing? Not one word about let's prosecute the people that are breaking the law here in the United States, right?
S&P futures down 73, NASDAQ futures down 390. This is after a horrible day yesterday, which we'll go through here in a second. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now,
right now. Hello, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Ricky on the board. S&P futures down 75. Yeah, 75. NASDAQ futures down. We just clicked under 400, 402. Not a good morning. This actually was starting to happen last Friday. We were down on Thursday, and we were down again on Friday. And because of the shutdown being over, we rallied back 400 or 500 NASDAQ points on Friday, and we're up like 500. We had like an 800-point turn. Now we've erased all that the other way, and I think we're lower than we were last Thursday night. I haven't checked yet, but I think we probably are. Dow's down 358. And here's even somewhat interesting is I was kind of ranting and raving yesterday about the people who were invited to the White House, the Wall Street people, Goldman Sachs, and how the stock was up $30 before the meeting. Well, it's given all of that back and then some. So whatever people thought was going to happen at the meeting must not have happened, but I wasn't there, and neither was Carl. Ricky, were you at that meeting? I don't think so. DAX down 415, 1.7%. FTSE down 182, 1.9%. CAC around down 133, 1.6. So the carnage is happening over there as well. Nikkei down 905, that's 1.8%. Hang Seng down 500, that's almost 2%. Shanghai down 39, that's a full 1%. So what's going on here is worldwide. Oil up 97 cents, but still 59.66. Heading back to that 60 number, which it seems to always want to come back to lately. Brent up 86 cents, 63.87. Gold, whack, 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 down 127, 4,067. That's 3%. Foreign exchange, we've got the dollar is actually down a little bit this week. The euro's up to 116. British pound, 131.6. Crypto, and this Carl's going to talk about this, I hope, down another 3,500, 94,000 on the Bitcoin here. That's a long way from the 126 a month ago. Yesterday, we don't normally do this, but Dow is down 787, S&P's down 113, that's almost 2%, NASDAQ down 536, that's 2.3%, and we got another 1.6 today, so we're talking 4% in 2 days if we stay here. Maybe people will buy the dip, maybe not. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:36 here in Chicago, 47 degrees right now with a high of 63. Mostly sunny today, pretty nice compared to what we've had lately. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 57 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 58 degrees right now with a high of 86. Very warm with variable cloudiness. Tonight, cloudy with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, we're looking at 60 minutes. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose. Inez from Lane Cook, 30 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 35 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 28 minutes. And lastly, Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 34 minutes. Sports, this Saturday, November 15, tomorrow, we have Maple Leafs at Blackhawks at 6 p.m. Yesterday, the Suns beat Pacers 133-98. And then NFL, Patriots beat Jets yesterday 27-14. And this Sunday, November 16, we have Bears at Vikings at 12 p.m. And 49ers at Cardinals at 3:05 p.m. Back to you guys.
We can pile in here anywhere in any of this stuff. It seems like, you know, we have a bunch of people on the show, a bunch that we all are recognizing a lot of what the problems are that affect regular people. And obviously, medical costs is up there. And I'm always astounded at as to how somehow or another we are collectively brainwashed by where this is all gone. I mean, you bring up a bunch of stuff, and I have to believe that when people talk about, you know, the cost, it's got to be what is if PTI? I'm not sure. I haven't asked my bro. What is the current price? Now, we don't have for a while We had a bunch of old guys, and we had a bunch of young girls, which is absolutely the wrong mix.
Boy, that's backwards, right?
Yeah, so the highest cost people are older people and childbearing year ladies. I think we were, if we had that mix of people today, and we always had a really nice plan for people, I'm thinking $2,500 a month minimum.
Maybe 20. Yeah.
So let's say that's what it is.
You'd be having a bad time.
Saying that's when people, you know, we constantly are ragging about the CPI stuff, 6.5% of the, and you'll see, the last two administrations, both useless when it came to this stuff. Well, one was certainly useless, and Trump was useless in his first one, and I don't know if he's making any strides here. But they're constantly talking about maybe lowering prescription drug costs for Medicare people, which is the stuff the government pays for. So I can see why they're sort of worried about that. But my other cause, my point always is, what about the rest of us?
How about everybody else?
But I'm saying just the math, $2,500 a month times 12 is what, $28,000?
Well,
by my
see,
math?
This is.
Is that right? If that's 6% of the basket, what do they think everybody's paycheck is? $300 a year? that ain't happening. It's got to be.
Chief, they're lying. Okay, and we all know that, right? I mean, this is the essence of it, right? Is that it's all a bunch of BS. But here's the thing, though, that when, you know, everybody, so there's two things that are going on right now, market related. One is that NVIDIA's CEO and a few other people have, and finally, this depreciation thing is being noticed. Secondly, this stuff about China is being noticed. People are starting to put two and two together on the power situation. All right, there is an article out this morning again. Gee, go figure. That, hey, wait a minute, these guys in Maryland put up a data center, and all of a sudden, I've got the utility filing for 30% rate increases on residences. Okay, why? Because they can't generate it. They have to buy it on the market. And, by the way, it's expensive when you have to do that, when you have to go outside on an emergency basis.
What Carl's saying is you've got to take other people to add to the grid so you can pull it off on your end, correct?
Yeah, and so basically the bottom line is that the cost that the utility company, utility companies are regulated monopolies, right? But as a result, when there's an increase in the cost of acquiring the thing they sell you, in this case electricity, guess what happens to your rates?
Yeah.
All right. And so, we're going to use more, we're going to go ahead and put this data center in that's going to use more power than we can generate locally within our utilities footprint. Therefore, we're going to have to buy it on the open market. By the way, that price is higher than we can generate it, but we can't generate enough. And guess what that means is going to happen to the price to you as the consumer. It's going to
be all of you, not just them, the new people.
No, not just the new people. Everybody gets screwed.
Yeah.
Everybody gets screwed, right? So there's some pushback coming there. But then the other thing, and this one started to seep in. I started to see some stuff about this, and I've been talking about it for a long time because it goes back all the way to when the Ukraine-Russia thing started. Okay.
Well, this current sell-off is about 2.5 weeks old, sort of interrupted by the thing.
But Chief, a big part of what has been levitating things is that the Fed is going to come to the rescue because there's no inflation, and therefore they can cut rates and da-da-da-da-da-da. Look, I have been talking about this since we took a policy position and started sanctioning people, all right, because I saw it immediately in the currency flows. It showed up instantaneously, and it has not gone away, and it's not going to go away. And I'm going to put a quantification on this for you, because this is probably the most important thing that is not being talked about in any kind of
size. It's not going to be talked about because nobody understands it.
It doesn't matter, Chief. It's going to drive price down.
I get it.
Okay? And here's the bottom line. From 2010 to 2020... global trade in goods, leave services out of this because services don't get prepaid, they get paid for at the time they're consumed, okay? But goods on a global trade basis, the guy who's making it has to get paid. If he doesn't, he goes out of business. Right? It's very simple.
And he has to get paid soon enough, or else he's got to factor it, or there's more to this than meets the eye. Go ahead.
But he has to get paid, ultimately. Right. Okay? All right. If the funds get seized, he doesn't get paid at all. All right? And when we started sanctioning God and anybody that had any peripheral connection to Russia, all of a sudden, the desire to have that in-transit cash held up in dollars went away. Duh. Okay.
Well, it's like saying, just to bring it down to every man, they used to say net 90, 230, net 90 or something along those lines.
2%, 10, net 30 or something.
Yeah, something like that. But it used to be, you'd send somebody a widget, and of course the guy doesn't pay you cash at the door. I mean, there's a float there. Depending. So if the guy pays you in 30 days, pay the invoice, and a lot of times people would say, if you pay me in 10 days, take 2% off or something.
Right.
But now sometimes it's 6 months. If it's the state, sorry about this going off a little bit. If you look around, don't see any independent drugstores. That's because the state wasn't paying anybody for a year, and my and Pa can't carry $100 on something they made 5 hours on.
Well, here's the basic problem though. The U.S. dollar was that sequestering currency on a preferred basis for global trade, and the reason is it was more stable than the other alternatives. Right? Had nothing to do with anything else. And essentially what this gave us, when you look at the increase in volume, it's not the volume, it's the change. It's the delta that matters.
Yep.
When you look at what happened over that period of time, we added approximately $10 trillion in global trade in goods. I'm not paying any attention to services at all here because, again, there's usually not a float issue there. In goods, there always is. $10 trillion across 12 years is about $700 billion a year in increase. All right? That is $700 billion that the U.S. Treasury can issue notes or bonds or whatever on without an inflationary impact in the United States because it gets absorbed on a temporary basis. Yes, it comes out, but it's the delta. It's the change that results in this.
It comes out, but then if it stays steady, you're okay.
Well, if it stays steady, then there is no benefit to the United States. But the growth in global trade means that if you're the currency where that happens, and this is not a reserve currency thing. People think this is about reserve currencies. It's not. It has nothing to do with reserves. This is simply about the flows. But what this means is that $700 billion a year worth of our deficit spending was not ending up in the American consumer's inflation. Okay, just wasn't. Now, the day that we started hammering people with sanctions, that disappeared. It's gone. And you can't get it back because it's all about trust. And we destroyed it. Now, maybe that was a policy decision that was worth making. That's a separate conversation.
I don't think the thing was ever brought up that way.
People just did it.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether it was done with stupidity, whether it was done with knowledge. It makes absolutely no difference. It's water over the dam, and it can't come back.
Right. I agree.
Okay? Now, the problem with that is this. That $700 billion, that is a huge amount of money. It's twice plus the corporate income tax receipts to Treasury. It's about a quarter of personal income tax
receipts.
Yeah,
it's a big number.
It's twice the Medicare tax receipts that come into Treasury in a year. Right? We're not talking about small potatoes here. If for every dollar that the federal government spends in deficit today, all of it shows up in inflation. There is no more sequestration. And if you look at when the inflationary impulse came in the economy over the last 5 years, it was as soon as we did that. That's where it came from.
Well, it happened earlier when the money supply went up here during COVID.
You can talk about money supply, but if you increase the money supply by $1 trillion and I take $700 billion of it and I sequester it, it doesn't show up in prices. Okay? That's mathematics. And the problem now, and I think people are starting to recognize this in the market, the idea that the Federal Reserve has the ability to play the games that it did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, before the Russia-Ukraine.
Well, the huge issue with the trade happened during COVID, where all was stopped. That was a big problem, too.
I understand that. But the thing is that was relatively short-lived. Okay, those goods started to flow again within the space of a few months. This is a permanent structural change in the flows, the funds flows for international trade around the globe. It is not going to go back to what it was.
Is that the same thing that's happened to Bitcoin in the last few days?
Well, it's part of what's doing this is that the entire premise on this is that we can, that, you know, if you think about it, the money supply thing is all about being able to increase leverage, right? Because where's it go, among other things, into margin debt. But it also, you know, gets borrowed and spent.
Well, the money supply thing, I think what's happened, and now if Milton Friedman was still alive, I think he maybe would agree with me, with too many people. But when you did what we did during COVID, when you poured so much money...
Well, that was crazy.
And we poured so much money in the system. When I was in school, if you increased the money supply or decreased it, it was a six-month lag for it to work its way through the system.
Right.
But in the COVID situation, they poured so much money in that really... The economy couldn't even absorb it. This is kind of what Carl's talking about. So actually, M0, which is money that the banks had that they kicked back to the Fed every night, became bigger than M1, which like never happened before. So even though they were pushing the money out, it was kind of coming back to them at night. So it took a while for it to actually get through the system. And when the economy opened up again, then that's when the inflation really started. Because right. Before that, I mean, it almost couldn't because you couldn't get it into the system.
Yeah.
So it's not just because we're doing this stuff so half-assed now, you can't even look at the old parameters and say it takes 6 months or not. It's almost, can the economy absorb it? Well, but now when you have stuff like the way it's being absorbed, or was until the last 2 days, was in massive amounts of margin buying in like stocks.
Right.
And even in houses, and even in some of the cryptocurrency stuff.
Right.
So you can do that tomorrow. And all of a sudden, if a guy's stock goes up 10%, and he had $1 million in an account, and now he's got $1.1 million, he feels like a drunken sailor on shore, right? And then he's going to use that to buy the thing on the house. He's going to buy the new car. It becomes part of the deal. Right?
Right,
I mean, it's a question of where does it pop out, and do people feel that it's wealth? It hasn't gone into earnings, really.
Right,
it's gone into wealth. It's gone into the wealth of baseball teams and football teams and stocks, right? Which is not the best. Very few people, and the reason why we're talking about SNAP payments and all this other stuff, very few people have gotten a 30% raise in the last 3 years.
Like nobody,
and actually more like 40% they need to stay even, and you know, with the health insurance and all the other stuff that's happening. So, Carl's absolutely right. It's not just how much you pour in; it's the rate of absorption.
Well, yeah,
Is that one way of saying it? Sort of,
because the thing is that you know it goes somewhere, right? This is always the dilemma: is that you can control the supply of money and credit, but you can't control where it goes. All right, at least not with any kind of specificity. I mean, you can try, but that tends to be kind of like herding cats, you know.
Well, if you had the guys from the University of Chicago, if they all could come out of their grave, the one thing I would argue with them, and I think I might win on this, Carl. You could be the referee. If you were to ask those guys, what was the cause of the Great Depression? They wouldn't say the market crash. They would say that the Fed allowed the money supply to drop, what, like 40 or 50% about a year, 6 months to a year, right? Which I can't argue with that piece. But their solution would have been the Fed should not have let that happen.
Yeah, well, that's nuts.
That I think, over time, I think is nuts. Because now I feel, Carl, just, and you and I are talking about the same thing. It's not so much what you do, it's the way you do it. if you would have said, hey, we got this problem, and any bank that's going to shut down, we're going to run in there and we're going to get Grandma Carl, who's in there looking for her $500, and the door just hit her in the ass, we're going to say, no, Grandma Carl, here's your $500. If you'd have done it that way, I think you'd have been okay. If you would have let all the carnage happen, and Grandma Carl is broke, Grandpa Carl's broke, they're out on the street, and all of a sudden you pour money into the system from the top, like these idiots did this time, I think you'd have made it worse for Grandma Carl, not better. If you didn't get back to... That's kind of what you're talking about. It's not just pouring it in. It's not just the big number. It's how you're doing it and where it's going.
Well, yes and no, because here's the basic problem. When you have the kind of mania that we've had on a sequential basis, on a recurring basis, really since the 1990s, okay? They never let this unwind after the crash in 2000.
They loved it.
But here's the problem. When you do that, the next one's bigger and harder to deal with. And you start pushing it into more and more areas of the economy. So, you know, you had the tech wreck, which was, for the most part, confined to places that really shouldn't have. I mean, the insanity that they were peddling was garbage. Right? Well, it was just flat out. And I was in the middle of this. All right. I mean, I don't think they. The useful parts of the internet did not die because they were useful.
But,
all right, they stayed. But here's the thing. Then all of a sudden, it's like, well, we can't really let that. So what did you do? You sowed the seeds of what happened in 2007 and 2008.
Here's
the thing. In 2007 and 2008, if you had let prices come back to where they were from a reasonable degree of affordability. Now that would have wrecked a lot of people, right? But if you've done that, it's like I was saying at the time during the middle of the crash. We can't let these banks fail. Da, 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 da. I'm like, look, a bank, the essential function a bank performs for the average Joe, is a necessary one. If the one that's up there on the corner closes, and goes out of business, believe me, a week from now somebody's going to open another one.
Right.
All right. Why? Because the guy still wants a car loan. He still wants a place to direct deposit or take his paycheck and cash it. Right? These functions have to be performed.
The banking function is clearly one we need.
The function will be met by the market. Okay. Now, will the and oh by the way, I really like the idea of buying that bank building at 10 cents on the dollar, because that makes me more competitive with the other guys.
Okay? Well, sure. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I love that idea. I made an awful lot of money buying stuff from people that blew up when I ran my company.
I think what happened, though, Carl, and this is actually a pretty serious accusation against the people who run shit in this country, whoever they are. After 2000, and they... You know, the markets always crash, and they put more money in the system. We start, and all of a sudden, it started to look pretty good for some people. We had a constant 6-7% growth in the money supply we were growing at 1-1.5% maybe. So yeah. There was this constant dribble of asset prices creeping higher than wages. I mean, it's constant dribble for a little bit every year. Just, I mean, not enough.
Right.
It was like, you know, you're on the block, and one guy comes out and gives you a light kick in the ass, and after 3-4 days, well, that's not so bad. All of a sudden, it gets a little heavier, until pretty soon he's knocking you down. Well, not because, I mean, if you look at where I'm going with this is, if you look at the salary of an individual, the median salary in 2000 was around $30,000, and I think now it's probably 44. I'm not talking about a family. I'm talking about a person.
Right, media. Right.
But if you look at the price of, say, the Bears in 2000 versus today, it's got to be up, 15 times?
Yeah, it's stupid.
It's stupid numbers. And same way with the market. I mean, they're stupid. And housing prices. So it started to feel so good for those people. They never wanted to pull it back. They were getting away with it.
I understand that, but here's the thing. The sink that was there that allowed a lot of this manipulation, that allowed this game to be played, it's gone.
Right.
That's the key thing that everybody needs to understand right now.
But it was happened so gradual, Carl.
No, it's not gradual.
It did over, it's 25 years for God's sake.
I get that, but we destroyed it with a policy decision when the Russia-Ukraine thing started.
Plus, we also got a little too greedy and we kicked it up a notch.
Well, yes, but the buffer that was there is gone. If you are in the camp that rates, you know, that Miley and, you know, the Trump screamers are, by God, we're going to have 2%, you know, 10-year treasuries again. No, you're not. Because if you do, you're going to have 25% inflation and there's going to be a revolution. So, because at that point, people can't eat, whether you have SNAP or not. All right. And so that can't happen. And it's starting to sink in to
it's fraying around the edges.
It, you know what? The day that that people recognize that the reason it can't happen is because that $700 billion a year sink is gone and cannot be rebuilt, you can't put it back together again, because we made a policy decision in concert with people in Europe. This is the reason that it's not just in the United States, it's worldwide.
Yeah, it was all did it together. That's a scary part.
Europe did the same thing, okay? Europe was an equal partner in this. Great Britain was an equal partner in this. This sanctions regime was a global decision, but it has global consequences. And as a result, the idea that you can run this game again is now gone.
Well, when you talk about stuff happening gradually like that, and I'm going to say, Carl, that right now I'm a way better money manager than I was back then. And one of the reasons why is when I learned the market, sometimes the market went up, sometimes it went down. Right. You know, it was that, but I never was able to just see these guys were going to get away with this year after year after year in the 2000s. And I just never got my people flat-ass long and stayed there. I mean, I always...
Well, and you know what? For the last 5 years, that has been the wrong strategy.
Well, yeah. Now all of a sudden, you know, the stuff that we do that used to always make a lot of sense. There was a 7-8 year period there where, what are you doing? You don't need any puts. I mean, but, you know, it's funny when you talk about we got to go, but there's a cartoon I'll never be able to find it. Talk about gradual. Because this happened, you know. Does anybody really care if there's a growth of 2% 1 year and there's a money supply growth of 5.5% and something goes up a little bit? Does anybody care? No. Next year, nobody. I think it was a Mr. Boffo cartoon where the guy, who was the goofball, it was always not Lewis, the other guy. And she says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm moving the cubicle of our boss in a 16th of an inch."
Right.
And she goes, "What are you doing that for?" He goes, because he'll never notice. He goes, I've been doing it for 2 years. All of a sudden, the next cartoon is the boss trying to squeeze his ass into the thing, and he never noticed. that cartoon is exactly what we did to the economy during the 2000s.
Yeah, and yet, but you know what? It's the bill's on the table now.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. And people that think that they're going to be able to pull that same rabbit out of the hat again, you're wrong.
But do we mean if all of a sudden the fix is, what's going to happen when Major League Baseball teams go from $9 billion down to four, where probably they ought to be, or two?
Two.
I mean, or one or something. What are we doing here? I mean,
well, what you're going to do is you're going to find out who's been swimming naked, which is pretty much everybody.
Yeah, well, that's...
So, I mean,
and that happy thought. Did your team have... Who are you guys playing this weekend?
The Vols are... We had a bye last weekend.
Are you still in the playoff hunt? I think you are, aren't you?
I believe so. Tomorrow we're home. But it's against New Mexico, which okay.
Where did you guys land on the valuation thing that I sent out?
Oh God, I don't know. But the funny thing is they're talking about now they want to expand Neyland, the stadium.
Well, how many thousand people are in there now? 80.
Oh God, it's huge. It's freaking enormous. But you know, it's not enough. And then the other thing is...
It's never enough, Carl. Haven't you figured that out by now?
Not only that, but there's a deal that has always been around. If you're an alumni and you have the tickets that that basically you're protected, okay? Well, they have, over the years, they found ways to screw those people.
Oh, yeah. You got to pay for a yearly fee.
Well, and this will be another one, okay, where they'll screw people out of their seats. because, you know, oh, well, you know, the stadium's not the same stadium, even though it is, but they just put another deck on it or, you know, whatever they did. Yeah. So I don't know how that's going to go. But, hey, you know what? The cure for high prices is high prices. They priced me out before I ever lived here. I'm not paying what they want to go see those
Does anybody even know the concept of dollar votes anymore? The basic economics that you and I learned, I don't think I even teach that anymore, do they?
I you know what? People just whip out the credit card. They don't care. And it'll work right up until it comes up declined.
All right, buddy. Have a nice weekend. Talk to you on Tuesday. On Monday, we're going to have Diane Kelly on, so we'll kind of wrap up the veteran stuff, kind of where we started. Cool. Diane was got us started on this stuff, and I tell you, I've had people write in that I haven't heard from in ages saying the last week was one of the best weeks we've had in terms of doing good stuff for everybody. So that's pretty cool. Carl, you're part of it as usual, buddy. Ricky, nice job. And NASDAQ futures down 368. Dow future or S&P down 65. So not good here. Maybe a Biden dipper will come by. We'll see. We'll talk all about it Monday morning.
Yeah. All right.
That's all, folks.